Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here.
Reminding you that a lot of life's firsts are better with help from American Family Insurance.
Like your first home expansion.
Or your first big lightning strike.
There's a first for everything. Get the right home policy at the right price with the right help from American Family's agents.
Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Critically Acclaimed, the movie review podcast where I really don't think we should get started until Jonathan gets here.
Jonathan!
I just feel like Jonathan would really understand what we're vibing with right now.
You know, you just made a reference to the movie Dungeons & Dragons, Honor Among Thieves.
We did.
Which is not a film we're reviewing on this podcast.
No.
So people are going to tune in and be, like, think they're hearing, like, a rerun or something.
Mm-hmm.
I know this is a podcast and we don't do reruns.
But listen, I'm going to tell you this right now. I would love to talk about this.
Okay.
But I think we should wait until Jonathan gets here. I will say this about Dungeons & Dragons, Honor Among Thieves. A movie I liked when it came out. Didn't love, but I liked. It did something only great movies do. It wormed its way into my brain. And now, when almost anything is about to happen, my first thought is, I feel like we should wait until Jonathan gets here. Like, oh man, it's going to be a really good Christmas. Wait. We should wait till Jonathan gets here. Oh man, I'm going to really dig into these McNuggets. No.
Wait for Jonathan. Wait for Jonathan.
And then he shows up and he's this adorable animatronic. I love him.
That Dungeons & Dragons movie is pretty terrific.
Mm-hmm.
In that it's, it worms into you. It's like pleasant and affable.
Mm-hmm.
It's like actually kind of funny and the cast is really committed.
And I remember almost nothing about the plot. It's all the incidental stuff that just was just this, very cozy and made me feel just, very happy.
This just proves my thesis that story is not as important to films as people say it is.
I don't fight you on that very much. Anyway, welcome back to Critically Acclaimed. We review movies. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a film critic. That's right. Got to introduce myself. I write for The Wrap, and everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I'm a senior staff writer over at Slash Film. And I don't have a nickname.
That's okay.
And I review films and write many other articles besides.
This week on Critically Acclaimed, we're reviewing some films.
Some films. Yes. What are we reviewing this week?
I don't know.
Not Dungeons and Dragons.
No, I mean we could do it again.
I suppose so.
I haven't seen it in a while.
I still like it.
We should wait till Jonathan gets here. Anyway, we're going to be reviewing the new Rami Malek spy thriller, The Amateur, which I will say that way. The Christian animated Jesus biopic, The King of Kings, starring Oscar Isaac and Kenneth Branagh. The Alex Garland Civil War adjacent warfare.
It's not Civil War adjacent.
Well,
it's just another war picture. Civil War came out last year.
And this year is adjacent to last year.
Sure.
Chronologically. We're going to be reviewing the new Christopher Landon thriller Drop. The new Die Hard knockoff starring Viola Davis as the president who's doing all the fighting, G20. And one-to-one, John and Yoko, a documentary about two people.
They just happened to be named John and Yoko.
Yeah, total coincidence, actually. I know you're thinking of those other Johns.
It's John Lennon and Yoko.
Oh, never mind. It isn't a coincidence at all.
No.
Anyway, let's review some movies. The one movie we saw this week that we both saw, which is an unfortunate trend that I do not like, when we don't both see at least a few films.
Can kind of bounce off each other
a little bit. Listen, I love having the conversation with you, but I prefer it when we get to... There are weeks, not often, but when we see all the same movies. And it's a joy, because we're sharing things together. But you get to tell me all about stuff, and I can tell you about stuff. But,
that's true.
The one thing we both saw was The Amateur, which I will say like that.
The rank amateur, this one.
Hey!
The amateur is a big load of spy hooey. It's one of those spy pictures about spies. But
one of those spies.
But as they exist in movies.
Oh, yeah.
That they're up to, like, cool stuff, and they're all super capable, and they think nothing of just committing grievous acts of extreme violence.
Okay, but let's be fair here. There's like a range of cinematic spy movies. Uh-huh. And on like one end, there's like serious, at least somewhat plausible spy movies and the Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy kind of vein. And then on the other end of the spectrum, there's Die Another Day, or some of like the wilder, ridiculous spy movies that are more wish fulfillment action fantasies than anything else.
I in most of these spy movies, there exists some sort of spy organization, sometimes real, sometimes imagined. James Bond works for MI6, for instance.
Real place.
That have this secret cabal of super trained violence agents, superheroes essentially, that are given weapons, pay no attention to extradition.
I mean, generally.
Travel around the world, and they are given license to pretty much murder enemies of their country.
We're just going to trust you to make all the decisions for the planet, and if you have, you know, got to kill a couple of evil guys, and we're just going to trust your word on that, there's not going to be no due process.
And we've come to accept this world so easily in spy movies that we don't really think about it much anymore.
I do, all the time.
Rami Malek works for the CIA, real agency, but he works for a movie version of CIA.
Well, but here's the
thing. So he's allowed to essentially travel abroad with weapons under CIA training.
Sort of.
To get blood revenge.
Sort of. Now, I want to make it clear. Involved. When I was talking about how there's a range of spy movies, you made it sound like the amateur is like a 10 in Die Another Day territory.
No.
It's not. It's not a 1. It is not a 1, but I would say this is in like a 4 or 5 kind of range, halfway in the middle.
I'd say it's
trying to be kind of plausible, but it can't tell its story and actually be realistic.
It's an 8 in 3's clothing is what it is.
Okay, now we're getting into weird math. The Amateur stars Rami Malek as a guy who works as a CIA analyst. His wife, played by Rachel Brosnahan, who has done a lot of TV. She's about to be Lois Lane in the new Superman movie.
Yeah, her name is Dead Wife in this movie.
She's about to die because at the beginning of the movie, she's saying goodbye, and they love each other, and they have wonderful coffee, and there's flowers on the table.
This will make my retirement tomorrow all the sweeter.
Basically. She drives away to on a business trip, and he runs after her car like it's a train in a 1940s movie. So she's going to die real soon. And indeed, she does. She dies on a business trip. There are a bunch of bad guys. We're doing terrorist stuff. And they took her as a hostage, and she died. And Rami Malek is like, well, this sucks for me. And he's very sad, as he would be. I'm with you so far, movie. But his reaction to this, grief, very reasonable. Less reasonable, I'm going to blackmail my bosses at the CIA and say, I'm going to tell the world about all this corrupt shit you've been doing.
That I found because I'm an analyst and a computer hacker.
Unless you train me like a secret agent and let me assassinate the killers myself. And when his bosses understand, honestly, corrupt or no corrupt, understandably go, that's weird. he really doubles down on it. And so they say yes, but it's really just stalling to see if he's actually has evidence and the goods.
Well, they set him up in the CIA weapons and violence training program.
The room in the back of the coffee shop in Wayne's World where all the ninjas are getting trained. He goes in there.
Handle guns. The training montage is pretty brief. It's overseen.
It makes it look like he's there for half a day.
Yeah.
His trainer for one day is Lawrence Fishburne.
Playing a Lawrence Fishburne role. Yeah. He's played roles like this a lot.
He knows how to do it. He's very convincing. But by the time they realize that we're just not going to let this guy do this, we're going to kill him, he has taken the half day of space secret agent training and fucked off. And now he's in Europe because you're going to have a half day of secret agent training, which is really just a feint so that we can look into you and try to get this evidence you supposedly have so you have nothing on us. But in that half day, we will give you perfect fake passports.
He gets perfect fake passports. He gets all of the airfare, I guess, he needs, or the transportation.
Yep. He learns how to make explosives perfectly.
And he, because of his computer hacking skills, he can locate the people involved or people adjacent to the people involved.
Well, he found them, and well, he found them actually pretty easily, and the CIA, he was like, well, that you can find them, right? And the CIA is like, we're not going to do that. We're very corrupt. And he's just like, oh, man. So
there's some passing line of dialogue about how, well, we can't get these bad guys. We want the whole network.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only line of dialogue they have.
Yeah. They also, the bad guys, here I'm going to give you their personalities in a nutshell. Paranoid. That's that one guy. Second guy likes rooftop swimming pools. Third lady has allergies and loves bread. So she's the complicated one. And then other guy.
And there's
the boss, basically.
The ringleader is played by Michael Stuhlbarg.
Yeah.
And
that's where we're at. He's going to spend the movie running around Europe, evading Lawrence Fishburne, and trying to find a way to kill all these people without actually shooting a gun. Because here's what I do like about The Amateur.
Hmm.
So what? Like, I don't hate this movie. I don't think it's particularly good. But there's one thing I like about it. They go back on it all the time. But at the very least, they address it.
Uh-huh.
Lawrence Fishburne tells Rami Malek, you may want to do this, you're not a killer. Like, you're going to have a gun in your hand, and you're going to need to shoot a guy, and you're not going to be able to do it. I know you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true, which is why he has to come up with all these bullshit workaround murders.
He's still murdering people.
He's still murdering people, but my point is this. They don't make murder cavalier. He actually does have feelings about it. And he's still letting himself do it, but he is trying to come up with some kind of way to excuse this morally. And he gets called out on it.
Yeah, you say he has feelings about it, and I wish I could have told that was going on in this movie.
No, because sometimes he looks downward a little bit, and he's like, oh, man. Yeah,
sometimes he stares into the middle distance without the same blank expression on his face.
Look,
Rami Malek, I feel like, is a pretty intense, quirky actor who can play certain kinds of roles, and this isn't one of them. I feel like we are able to accept a lot of these ridiculous spy plots and conceits and super... We kind of give moral pass to all of the violence. If the spy in question is really charming, or their adventures are really kind of action-packed in a really dazzling kind of a way.
Or there's really interesting.
Or if we get really involved in their emotional journey. I really need to get blood revenge.
I just love revenge.
Sometimes I accumulate
friends and family just in the hopes
that they get kidnapped so I can get revenge on the people who kidnapped them.
That's my kink.
Blood revenge only exists in movies, but all right.
I'm sure it's been done, but it's nowhere near as common as movies.
It's like a daily occurrence. The problem with The Amateur is that Rami Malek doesn't have that kind of James Bond dazzle, nor does he give me the impression that he is an amateur. That he's actually afraid of doing all of this stuff.
Because the setup is, what if someone who had maybe a half day of training tried to be James Bond?
Yeah.
Right? That's actually interesting.
Mm-hmm.
You would make a lot of mistakes. You wouldn't actually be good at all of the skills that we take for granted in the genre. All of that's actually pretty cool. But then they backtrack and say, like, yeah, but he has 170 IQ, and he was really good at the bomb part, and he's like a hacker. And I'm like, well, then he's not an amateur, is he? He's a little outside of his wheelhouse, but like Daniel Day-Lewis would be outside of his wheelhouse in a Friday the 13th movie. I think he'd be fine in it.
You need somebody who has like a little bit of self-effacement, who is actually... feels like they're out of their league. Somebody who we're not used to seeing in a spy movie. I feel like Rami Malek is almost action hero adjacent.
Like, I think you're right that, like, Rami Malek tends to really blossom when he's got an excuse to be, you know, odd in some respects. And as many actors do. And they're doing that Hollywood thing where they're going to make him, like, really serious and help him, like, have him, like, you know, maintain the screen that way. And it's not doing Rami Malek any favors. It's not doing the movie any favors. But there is an alternate version of this where someone like Paul Giamatti is putting himself in the field.
You're not used to seeing in a spy role
And here's the thing. We've had that. It's called Spy. It starred Melissa McCarthy as a CIA analyst who goes into the field. And the Lawrence Fishburne role is played by Jason Statham.
That's right.
And it's a much better movie.
Spy's all right.
Spy's a good. It's bloated. It doesn't like need
it's
to
way,
be
way way too long. It, you could definitely it's longer cut, like, than the amateur.
Like you could cut 40 minutes out of Spy and you'd have a really tight, funny film. But like when that movie's funny, it's funny as hell.
Yeah, and it actually has some charm, and we get to see people sort of comedically out of their element. The amateur, in addition to Rami Malek not having that kind of James Bond quality, it's also just a really gray, uninteresting, visually downbeat kind of a movie.
Yeah.
It's
like, it doesn't like want to be broadly entertaining, but it doesn't understand how to like be like cool
a script
otherwise.
This ridiculous needs that kind of big, dumb Hollywood treatment. There's the scene where he actually blackmails his bosses at the CIA.
Yeah.
He goes into their office, and we've seen him accumulating this blackmail material. And it's kind of, like, treated intensely. It's, like, zooming through and, like, thumbing through all of these files. Yeah. Like, wait a minute, they lied about this, and they lied about this. And he is learning, as we are, that his bosses are corrupt. And then he goes into their office, and you think the twist is going to be, I've caught you. What happens? I caught you, and I'm going to turn you into the police because I'm scrupulously honest fellow. And he sort of plops it down in front of them and says, "I've caught you, and now I'm going to blackmail you. I need you to give me training." And he just sort of delivers all this dialogue very matter of factly.
Like that's a weird and ask. You there, think yeah, that th- would
this needs to be? It needs to have a, like that moment like I've caught you. And then he needs to like put his palms like, and then like looks at him and in this really melodramatic way says, "But there's a twist."
Yeah.
I'm not going to turn you in. I'm blackmailing you. And there needs to be like a musical sting right, and no, like a reaction
like,
shot.
Like this
you
is know. A guy who is thinking outside the bun.
He needs to think, the movie, it needs to think inside the bun. It needs to be
my point is the
far more
is.
Like cliched and traditional for it to function if you're going to stick with
the
script.
The premise of the film requires the character to think outside the box. Mm-hmm. And they decided to play this like really icy and cool. And listen, again, there's a whole range of spy like tones you can play with. And I agree with you. I think there is either a very serious, almost Munich quality this could have had.
Yeah.
Or it needs to be bigger than this. I don't think you want to go a full 10. I don't think you want to go like full Moonraker. That's probably too much.
Not
but
full
like,
Moonraker, but think of some of those, hit a movies, seven, those I think. Movies Tom Cruise has been in. You know, a tone like that. One of those kind of just broad, audience-pleasing blockbuster kind of tones.
I still don't think that's quite right. But like, yeah, I do think that this is just listen. There's a solid premise. It's like a remake of a Canadian movie, which I haven't seen. So I understand why the premise got picked up again because the premise is kind of neat. It's just competent, and I don't. I think when in my review I called it kind of watchable, which isn't bad, but also I don't know anyone who's aiming for kind of watchable. You know?
Yeah.
Like, I'm just like, we are looking for baseline competence. We are going to spend a year of our lives producing something that's just kind of okay. And honestly, that's the, even though I had an okay time watching it, I kept expecting it to do more than it did, and it never quite did. Although there are a couple of scenes in this movie, I will say, that if I would bet good money, like I would bet like half a paycheck, that there's a couple of scenes with John Bernthal and there's one scene with Lawrence Fishburne, and I won't tell you which ones they are, but if you see it, you might be able to guess, that I think only exist because they're hoping this could be a franchise. Because John Bernthal doesn't connect to anything else in this movie. You lift him out of the movie, you remove one extra line of dialogue, you'd never know he was there.
At best, he's a red herring. It's like he was on set that day.
No, it really does. It literally feels like we just need someone to suggest sequel stuff. Mm. And that's kind of what he does. And then there's a bit with Lawrence Fishburne where it's just like, there's that great scene in National Lampoon's Loaded Weapon 1, which, by the way, is a very funny spoof movie.
It's underrated,
It's genuinely a lot of laughs in that movie. It stars Emilio Estevez and Samuel L. Jackson as the Riggs and Murtaugh character from Lethal Weapon, and Tim Curry is the bad guy. It's hilarious. But there's a bit at the end where their angry like commissioner tells them, like, good job, you guys. I'm going to put you on more cases from now on. And they just look at each other and go, sequel. As if like we know. Yeah, it just, it's generic. That's it, really. It shouldn't have been.
It's not even, it's not even generic. It's bland. generic is at least functional. Generic is like the middle of the road. This is not even as exciting as that. It doesn't, it can't muster up the energy to be generic.
I don't know if I'd go that far. Listen, I'm going to defend this movie. And I'm going to say, yes, it is generic.
Well, that's a bold stance you're taking.
I think
you
it's
maverick.
I think it's good enough to be generic.
Oh, okay.
Not much more, but it is good enough to be generic. I think this is just, oh, here's a spy movie. The end. Like, there you go. Like, your dad might enjoy watching this at, like, 3 o'clock on TNT with commercials. Like, that's where we're at cinematically. But tell me, okay, yeah. You're going to tell me about the movie I wish I'd seen this week, because okay. I have no idea if it's good, but every trailer made it look like, oh, they made this for me. tell me about Drop.
Ooh, Drop. Okay, this is the latest film from Christopher Landon.
Yeah.
Who did Happy Death Day.
And Happy Death Day to You.
And
yeah, and he's, and Paranormal Activity, The Marked Ones, but Nobody is Perfect.
He also did that film Scout's Guide to the Zombie Apocalypse, which is not
great. I didn't see that. But like lately, when he's been playing around with the horror genre, he's been very clever. He's got good energy. He brings good characters to it. Tree from the Happy Death Day movies is one of the best horror characters we've had in the last 10 years.
She is so great. And he also did a film a couple of years ago called We Have a Ghost, which was sort of like a Beetlejuice riff.
Wait, was that him?
That was him. Yeah, he directed
with
that
with David Harbour?
The one with David Harbour. It was also Christopher Landon. Yeah, directed that one.
I'm looking that up. That feels like a lie.
And that one actually, like, it falls into sort of Netflix syndrome. Where
it was a Netflix movie.
Yeah, it's clearly over-moneyed and goes on a little too long. And yeah, it's not one of his better films, but has a lot of good moments.
Shit, that was Christopher Landon. He wrote and directed that. That is a very generic movie.
Yeah.
I honestly remember almost nothing from that movie, except David Harbour was kind of likable in it as the ghost.
I was mad because they used one of my favorite pop songs to no effect. There's a scene where the ghost has to, like, run through like, several apartments, and they do it in slow motion in this big action sequence.
Yeah.
Like, pops up in people's lives, and then runs to the room and vanishes. Yeah, one of those montages. And they do it to Missing Persons' Words, which is one of the best pop songs ever written.
How's it go?
Do you hear me?
Oh, yeah,
do
that's a great song.
Care? Yeah,
yeah, it's a great song, yeah. What
are words for when no one listens anymore? Words for, yeah.
And I apparently didn't listen to the lyrics. I thought it was what are words worth.
Yeah, Dale Bosio, who Lady Gaga, I think, might have seen Dale Bosio perform at one point. But I love that song, like,
sure, it's a great song.
Quite deeply, and they just threw it in this, like, generic action sequence that has nothing to do with Missing Persons or the meaning of the song. It's like, come on, man.
Who did The Wire? I think it was David Simon, executive produced The Wire, wrote the book it was based on. I was listening to a commentary track from The Wire, and that show has some of the best needle drops ever. And he had a good philosophy on that. Here's how you do a needle drop. Either the music fits the scene or the lyrics do. Never neither and never both.
Both, it's too obvious.
Both, it's too obvious. Neither, it just feels
it's
jarring.
Yeah.
But if it's the lyrics are accurate but the song is not, you're going to get an interesting effect. And if the music is accurate but the lyrics are not fitting the scene, it's going to feel more organic. That's actually pretty good advice. I'm not saying it's universal. Sometimes you do want something really, really obvious because it's a joke. But generally speaking, pretty good advice, actually, I gotta say.
Yeah.
But in any case, the Happy Death Day movies are great. Freaky is great. I'm on board with Christopher Landon. I think he's got a good vibe. Not that he's perfect. What is Drop?
Drop is Christopher Landon doing his Hitchcock.
Ooh.
And a bit of Die Hard as well.
okay. Hitchcock probably would have done a great Die Hard, actually.
Well, the thing about Die Hard is it's one of those movies that really does have... Screenwriting students will tell you this. It's like, if you want to write a Hollywood movie, do that.
You're going to study Die Hard.
Study Die Hard.
Even the things in Die Hard that haven't aged great, it's still a great screenplay.
Yeah, like everything that's set up pays off. Things mm-hmm. pay off that you didn't realize were setups earlier on.
Yeah, there's a mathematical formula to Die Hard.
It's pretty exacting the way that kind of thriller ought to operate. Yeah. And I feel like Drop is taking a lot of notes from Die Hard.
There are worse movies to take notes from.
Good. Take your notes from Die Hard. The movie stars Megan Fahey as a woman named Violet, and we see in a flashback at the beginning that she is still getting over a really horrendous experience involving her ex-husband.
Okay.
She was in an abusive relationship, she had a young child, and through some bloody violent conflagration, he dies.
Okay.
And we flash forward a couple of years, her son is now 5 years old, and she's ready to start dating again.
Mm-hmm.
She has set up a blind date through one of the apps with this very kind, very handsome man who's played by Brandon Sklenar.
Okay.
Her sister is babysitting her son, and she goes to this restaurant in a high rise in Chicago.
Okay.
It's called Palette.
God. That sounds really plausible.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, God.
When she arrives, and this is when you're like really paying attention because they set up the maitre d', they set up the mm-hmm. bartender.
All these details will become important later.
There's this guy who's on an awkward date. There's the lascivious pianist. Are any of these people?
Okay, pianist. Took me a second. Got it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Is,
you kind of dropped that last consonant.
There's a table of prom kids. Mm. Are maybe some of these characters? Oh, there's the flamboyant waiter.
Mm.
Some of these characters might be important later on.
Ah.
Maybe they won't. But you're paying attention.
Yeah.
She meets her date. He's very, very kind. He's very handsome. The most patient man in the world. As we will learn as the film goes on. He's a photographer.
Is he Flawless Rescue Stead?
Almost. Okay. Almost. But,
which is the male equivalent of the Manic Pixie Dream Girl.
Yeah, he's not a Flawless Rescue Stud in that he doesn't just exist to make her feel better. But he's a pretty flawless dude.
The line you had that always makes me laugh mm-hmm. is, what was it?
I'm not happy unless I'm changing myself for you.
That's such a good fucking line.
that's
such a good line.
It's based on the movie Safe Haven. But,
yeah,
God. There's a... When she's sitting down, she gets some texts from, like, an AirDrop-like app that she has on her phone.
Mm.
And it means she can get a message from anybody in a network so long as it's, like, within 50 feet. So she's getting texts from someone in the restaurant because it's in a high-rise. Couldn't be anybody else.
I can't even imagine why I would own that app.
And
like, seriously, what am I going to get
at first,
out of that?
At first, it's like creepy memes, like, here's me, here's you, having a horrible evening. And, eventually, she starts getting texts saying, "Don't tell anybody about these texts, or I will kill your son." And she's like, "Okay, that's not funny."
Well, that's
anymore.
Not good. Yeah.
But then she gets a video feed. There's somebody in her house.
Yeah. Well, that's creepy, is what that is.
Like she can see
that's
her,
not good.
Her security cameras inside her house. And there's somebody inside her
that
house.
That is not good. That's a bad thing.
And the texts keep coming. It's like, "Don't tell your date, or I'll kill your son." Now, here you're going to get some instructions throughout the evening. You have to kill your date. Delicious.
That's cute.
It's, yeah, delicious premise.
Does she have a timeline? Like, you have to do it before dessert or something? Or
no, just she has to do it before the date's over. And so she has to put on a brave face, keep him interested so he doesn't leave, and follow these instructions to the best of her abilities. And,
yeah.
And you know, the goal is to kill him.
Okay.
Is she going to do it? Is she not going to do it? I don't want to give away too many details, but...
yeah. But that's a very Hitchcockian premise.
Yeah, and of course...
Could you kill somebody if you were forced to? Strangers on a train is about that.
Some things, it's like, okay, and she's trying to outwit this person, and she doesn't know who's, kind of sending her these texts. You know, she's eyeballing everybody in the room. Some people she rules out, some people she doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
She tries to call for help, but then, of course, maybe she's busted, maybe she's not.
Right.
Meanwhile, her date is, like I said, being the most patient person. I need to move tables. I can't do this. Can we go get some drinks? We have to move back to the other table. She figures out how this mysterious person is communicating and spying on her, but she can't say anything.
And
he starts catching wise, like, "You're behaving really weird. I know you can't be away from your son." And they have...
He's so understanding.
And he's like...
And that makes him harder to kill.
And he's so understanding. Like, implausibly understanding. Yeah. But in a way you like.
Because that's a fine line.
You want him to stick around. And this is a fine line because
you want him to be... You want to like him enough that you don't want him to die.
But you don't want him to be so understanding that he seems stupid.
Or suspects. Like, we're going to find out he's actually a serial killer or something.
Or maybe he is.
I'm not going to do that. I don't want you to tell me the twist. Because obviously we're going to find out what's really going on, right? Yeah. Don't tell me what's really going on. I'm going to ask you a yes or no question.
Okay.
Okay? When we find out what's going on, will it make sense?
It plays fair.
Okay. I'll say that's fair. That's good to know.
They don't give you a big reveal with a new piece of information that you couldn't have guessed, for instance.
Right. Okay. So like if you're watching it, it's not you're actually the movie is just playing fair. It's giving you all the information you need. Okay, that's good, because sometimes you watch a movie and it's got a great setup, and then you realize they have no good justification for why this is happening.
Yeah, and can you guess what's coming? Yeah, maybe. Some things are broadcasted in movies like this, some things... Mm-hmm. I try not to, like, guess out ahead. I wait for the movie to tell me the way it wants to tell me. Sometimes I can see it coming, but... It's the way they give me the information that's important, not how they hit it.
I think sometimes movies are being very direct about wanting the audience to interact, like a whodunit, like Knives Out, wants you to try to outguess the movie.
Yeah.
They were encouraging you, like, can you do it? Mm. Can you figure out who the killer is? And you're encouraged to do it, and hopefully the movie can outsmart you.
Yeah.
Is the trick.
I'm very fond of an author named Harry Stephen Keeler, who is... sort of like the Ed Wood of whodunits. He has written some of the most bizarre, strange, out there, and frankly quite terrible murder mysteries out there. McSweeney's rescued some of his works. McSweeney's printed his book, The Riddle of the Traveling Skull, which I'm very fond of. I Killed Lincoln at 3:17 is one of his books. The Case of the Transposed Legs. It's like... he's got some really, really odd stories.
Nice.
I highly recommend Harry Stephen Keeler. But the publisher or the author, I don't know who thought this up, had a page about 4/5 of the way through of the book that said, stop, you've been given all the information. You should be able to figure it out. Write down on this little page who you think did it. You can never figure it out because the solutions are always so fucking weird.
Yeah. That's a fun gag, though.
Yeah.
They're like, ooh, I'm being called out.
And when movies do that, it's death. Like, you can figure out. You have all the information, and then they just give you new information after that anyway.
Well, that's when it's bad.
Yeah, that's...
When it's bad.
And I've seen plenty of mysteries that do it poorly.
I absolutely have. And the problem is that if they're playing fair, sometimes, if they're really playing fair, you can figure it out.
Yeah, I will say that Drop, it plays fair. It's not going to be this big mind-blowing twist, but it's so exquisite. It's so much fun.
Yay!
It has, like, fun, badass action lines, and like Die Hard, there's, like, little tiny setups that you didn't realize are setups that pay off in really great ways right in the film's climax.
That's really great. This was the movie, like, I really wanted to see this week. There was a screening, but I had to go to another screening because that was the one I had to review in print, and it was the only time they were showing it, and then I wanted to go this weekend, and then I had to help clean my mother's house, and it pisses me off, and I really don't want it ruined before I see it, but I'm really, really glad it's fun. That's really cool. Okay.
I like it a lot. It's one of my favorite movies of this year.
Wow.
I think it's great.
That is a hell of a compliment. Yeah. Well, I saw a Die Hard.
You did see a Die Hard.
I saw a Die Hard.
Tell me about your Die Hard.
This was the Die Hard I saw while you were watching your Die Hard.
Uh-huh.
It's a movie called G20. It stars Viola Davis as the President of the United States. Now, she was a war hero, and she was elected President of the United States. And now she's going to go to the G20 summit with her husband and her two Disney Channel kids, one of whom is a hacker. And the other one is there as well. He doesn't have anything to do. I'm not sure why we needed him. But anyway, she's going to the G20 summit. It's in South Africa. And she's going to present her plan to tackle global poverty. And she said it out loud, what the plan is. And all I got was something, something, something crypto. Like, that's what I got.
She's using crypto to solve poverty somehow?
I guess, and then...
Isn't crypto just a way to launder money?
Well, hang on, because the movie's attitude towards crypto is very conflicted and confusing. The bad guy in the story is your Alan Rickman, if you will.
Hmm.
It's played by Anthony Starr from The Boys.
Okay.
Who's a fun actor.
Hmm.
Doesn't have a lot to work with here. It feels like his main note was keep darting your eyes around like you're tracking a mosquito in the room. Like, that's
Is it the shifty-eyed dog from The Simpsons?
No, because we know it's him immediately, but yeah.
Everyone will know it's the dog because they'll be a...
No, he's a shifty-eyed because I think that's what he had instead of a quirk.
Yeah.
He takes the G20 summit hostage, and the G20 summit is a meeting of a whole bunch of world leaders all in one place to discuss big global issues, usually climate change, but a lot of stuff. And he takes them all hostage, and, like... The president, President Viola Davis, and the prime minister of Britain, and like two other randos, and the lead of her secret service detail, they managed to evade capture, and now they're running around the G20 summit trying to die hard.
trying to die.
But Anthony Starr's...
Don't want to die easily.
But Anthony Starr's plan is something, 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 bad crypto. And what he's...
Oh, there's good crypto and bad crypto.
He's gonna use deepfake technology to show the world... like, videos of all these world leaders saying just openly, we're going to use cryptocurrency, we're going to control the world's finances and make ourselves richer. And Anthony Starr's like, see? These people I've kidnapped have very convenient videos, every single one of them. And now you should take all of your money out of banks and invest in cryptocurrency, and somehow, something, 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 I make $150 billion. I do not understand it. At all. I'm not entirely convinced it makes sense, but even if it does, it's not a very clean premise.
Also, given the current Reich's tendency to fleece us openly.
It's like, yeah, that's the other thing.
They're getting caught and nobody's stopping them.
Are you telling me that we're going to find out that the governments of the world are corrupt and only helping like billionaires?
Mm.
Well, shit.
Oh, everyone's going to do something. Get out. Yeah.
Everyone's going to do something about this. Mm. Yeah. We need a new wave of especially genre films where we don't fall back on these old fantasy ideas about the system working. I've talked about this a lot.
Yeah.
Like any plot point
if a corrupt politician gets caught,
yeah.
The threat of going to the press, we know in real life, means nothing.
And this is in The Amateur as well. Mm. He says, I'm going to tell the press. And I'm like, go for it.
Yeah.
Nothing's going to happen to us. We're in the CIA and we're conservative white men. We're fine. Like, not convinced that we're not living in that world anymore.
Yeah.
It just doesn't. It would be like imagine if every action movie had a plot point involving rotary telephones. You would say, hey, update that shit a little bit. Mm. We don't do that anymore. We don't do exposing corruption and people give a shit and there are consequences anymore. That's just not a thing. Anyway, Viola Davis runs around being Viola Davis and kicking butt.
Nice.
That's enough.
Yeah.
Literally, it's
Die Hard at the G20. That's
Die Hard at the
pitch,
G20.
Yeah.
It's not particularly well directed. In fact, the tone is all over the place. Hmm. Like, it opens with, like...
Who made it?
Hold on, I forget her name. I will look it up. So the action stuff waffles from like PG-13 to like surprisingly violent.
Hmm.
Not R-rated. I don't think it is R-rated.
All right.
I'm almost surprised. But like surprisingly, like, oh my god, that person just got stabbed in the neck and they're bleeding out everywhere. But every scene with Viola Davis's kids is a Disney Channel show. Like, it's completely bizarre tonally. It's directed by Patricia Riggin.
Trisha Riggin. Oh, God, I don't know.
I'm not terribly familiar with her work. She's in a lot of TV. She directed a couple of movies. Hang on. She did some episodes of Tom Clancy's Jack Ryan. She did that Christian movie Miracles from Heaven. She did that movie about the miners trapped in a cave-in called The 33.
Okay.
Yeah, not
familiar
not
with
a lot of
work,
prominent projects. You might not be familiar with her work.
But experienced.
Experience, can put together production. This feels... Listen, it's really, really fun to have a shot of Viola Davis wearing a beautiful red dress, but covered in Kevlar.
Okay.
Okay? like having just killed a room full of guys, and then one guy runs up from behind her while her back is turned, and she just punches the air behind her, and it hits him in the face, and he gets knocked out.
Like a Ninja Turtle.
Yeah, that's
that's great. What you're here for.
That's
here
why I'm here.
That ridiculous violence.
Viola Davis, and I love Viola Davis for this, because she's one of the most respected actors in the world. She's one of the best actors in the world.
Yeah.
She's been in some of the best dramas you've seen in many, many years, and she's always amazing in all of them.
She's an EGOT.
Yeah. She does have an EGOT.
She's an EGOT.
Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, Tony. She's does everything, and she's great at all of it. She also loves to kick butt. Like, she genuinely, and honestly, any male actor who was that celebrated would also have an action movie thrown at him.
Yeah.
Like, so just, hey, you know, I want to kick ass all the time. She was great in The Woman King, but that was actually like a dignified production that was like legitimately great. Uh-huh. This is her schlocky shit. It's like Die Hard. I think I was trying to come up with another example. Like, try to imagine, like, what if there was a Die Hard starring Glenn Close on a Zeppelin? Like, you'd want to see that! I wish I could say the movie was very good. Mm-hmm. It's not. It's got the plot's again, very predictable.
Like the amateur, you just need it to have...
Yeah.
Like, well, the right attitude toward its ridiculous action premise.
And here's the deal. It's got the right attitude. If it was just a little bit more competent, it would be genuinely quite good.
Oh, so it's just, like, not good filmmaking.
It's not particularly good filmmaking. Like, it's not awful, but, like, there are too many action scenes that are just Viola Davis, like, swirling around in slow motion in a smoke-filled room, firing off camera, and then we cut to a guy going, ah!
Oh.
You can get away with that a little bit. That cannot be the majority of the action. Because, you know, editing is an illusion. Editing gives you the idea that two things are happening simultaneously or that there's a cause and effect. When in actuality, they were filmed in different months.
Mm. Kuleshov effect.
Yeah, cool. Well, that's one example. But yeah, editing is magic, basically. Mm. We're savvy enough to know that if we never see the actor's face, it's not them. You know? Yeah. Like, we're savvy enough to know that, like, if just before an action sequence, an actor who is probably very busy and didn't spend 6 months fight training puts on a motorcycle helmet and then fights a bunch of guys, you know that actor didn't do that. Now, Viola Davis
spies who can conveniently fight with, like, a bag over their heads.
Right. And this is especially true in television where there's a lot of, everything moves so fast you don't have weeks to do every action sequence. Mm. So, yeah, Arrow's gonna have a hood over his head for this one. And I'm gonna forgive you for that because you do, like, 24 hours of cinema a year for that. That's fine. Here, again, they don't really do that. They don't, like, hide Viola Davis that much. But they're clearly hiding, I don't know if it's budget or just the amount of time they had to film it. It's not amazing. But cool Viola Davis president kicking butt, like killing a bunch of guys who are trying to crash the world economy with, like, crypto and shit. I mean, dude, I am there. Like, it's schlock. It's, like, straight to video schlock that somehow has Viola Davis in it. But It is watchable. Like, it's, and I don't mean amateur watchable, where, like, you can get through it. Like, I did enjoy myself mostly.
Yeah.
Not enough that I can say to myself, it's a hoot! Like I would say with White House Down. Like, everything about it is just so slick and ridiculous and fun. I give that movie an unabashed recommendation.
White House Down is a 4-star movie. It's
cheesy. It's
some of the best schlock you'll see.
Yeah, but it's cheesy, but it's impeccably done. This has that tone, but it's not impeccably done. And that holds it back a little bit. I think just a little bit more... I mean, it's Amazon, so God only knows how much it costs. But, like, they might have thrown money at this thing, and this is still what they turned out with.
Viola Davis, sure they paid out the nose for.
Yeah, I will say this. I was really bummed. You know, I write my own reviews, and sometimes there's a little editing. You know, they change a word here or there for they think clarity, and I don't always agree with it. But that's fine. I live with it. I work very hard on my headlines. And sometimes they don't get accepted, and that's part of the business. But sometimes it bothers me more than others. I worked really, really hard to develop the headline for this Viola Davis action movie, Violance solves everything. Listen, you, Whitney Seibold, might be making that noise.
Uh-huh.
I guarantee you, every single person listening to this podcast is still clapping right
now.
They're in traffic.
They're missing,
it's dangerous.
You they're missing this part of the conversation the because they're laughing so hard.
You should put your hands back on the wheel now. Thank you for your support. But yeah, I do appreciate your clapping. And I heard you. I heard you all. It was weird. anyway, G20. It's Thursday night. We're done watching dinner. Let's put on something ridiculous. I can't believe Viola Davis is in this.
Yeah.
But it could be a lot worse. Speaking of warfare, tell me about warfare.
warfare?
Yes. Mr. Warfare. Shields up.
That's when Worf goes. Warfare is the latest film from Alex Garland. He's a co-director of this film with a real-life soldier named Ray Mendoza, who experienced the 2006 Iraq war battle that this film dramatizes.
They
say in some chyrons at the beginning of the film that everything we're about to see is based only on some photographs that were taken in 2006 at the time of the battle, some things that were taken after the battle, some like little details, and then the memories of the soldiers who were involved.
Okay.
And this is just a very straight, and there's no other context beyond that. We know it's 2006,
yeah.
And we know it's in Iraq. The only introduction we get is all of the soldiers in uniform with their weapons are standing around in a little tent watching this sort of, like, softcore workout video, like something out of The Substance.
Okay.
And they're all hooting and hollering and getting horny together. After that, it is just straightforward dramatization of this battle. We don't know what the meaning of this battle is. We don't know what's at stake if they win or lose. We don't know who they're tracking. They only ever refer to the Iraqi soldiers as bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
And we see it from the inside of a house that they've infiltrated. They infiltrate these innocent people's house. They just sort of herd them into these Iraqi citizens into their bedroom. And they just say, okay, this is our base now. We've taken over your house. Kind of scary in this home invasion kind of way.
Yeah.
They drill holes in the walls. They start poking their weapons out. They're looking through their spy scopes. And then a big portion of the movie is just them kind of waiting around. And Alex Garland has been so good about giving us a very tactile experience of what all that is like. We get to feel what the temperature in the air is like, the little tiny details of what was in the kitchen when they were invading, you know, the firmness of the water bottles, the scratches on their guns, like all of these little things. The weight of their uniforms was really striking me, just sort of how complicated it is and everything that's in their kits. And then, of course, everything goes unexpected, and there's explosions. They have to start to arrange for some evacuation. The evacuations don't go so well. By the end of the film, there's some people who are very grievously injured. Some people have died. There's limbs blown out into the streets. There's some people screaming and screaming because they're so badly injured. And the things continue apace.
It's just this battle.
And it's just this one battle.
Okay.
And as soon as they're out, the movie's over.
Okay.
I wish we had a little bit of context. Mm. There's no conversations as to how they feel about the war or how they feel about being soldiers. Mm. It's, despite that opening, it's not really about sort of toughness or, it's not about heroism or cowardice.
Mm.
It's just sort of about the raw experience.
Mm.
And Alex Garland also did with his movie Civil War. He is trying to remain as neutral as possible in all of this, which is a galling thing for him to say, given how politically rife his films are in their context.
Especially lately.
Civil War is very specifically about where we are as a nation right now. What are we fighting for? What are the sides in the Civil War? His only thesis seems to be, it doesn't really matter what we're fighting for. War will rip apart the country.
War is bad, y'all.
Yeah, we get that. But you're choosing to make civil war now.
Mm-hmm.
You're choosing to choose different states that are unifying with each other now in a certain context, but you're not giving us any sort of actual context.
Yeah.
You're not letting us know. And that way it can't serve as any kind of like political allegory.
I maintain that Civil War is a great film about photography and a bad film about America.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's supposed to be about America, and it's more about the ethics of war photography. It's like you could have done that without pointing us in this really politically ripe direction.
We didn't need sci-fi for that.
Yeah, yeah.
You could have just, I mean, not that it's like hard sci-fi, but it's like speculative fiction. What we
could have taken an existing war. There's plenty to choose from.
Yeah.
And here now with Warfare, he's doing the same thing. He's backed off. There's no message here. It's really weirdly empty. It's not some sort of anti-war polemic where he's lambasting sort of the dangers of the foolishness of the Iraq War.
Mm.
But it's also not like act of valor where he's trying to point out sort of the peerless bravery of the American military.
Well, is it competence porn? Is that what it is? Like, look at these guys doing what they do best kind of thing?
Well, it would be if we saw them like achieving and doing something really grand with it, or if they were accomplishing some kind of goal. They didn't do that. It was just about their soldiers. They were given a job. They did it. They got out. Maybe they didn't do it. They do dangerous things. Of course they do dangerous things. They're in a war zone.
Yeah.
Everybody in a war zone is doing something dangerous, whether you're a soldier or not. Mm. You're just sort of in a dangerous area. And I got to read an interview with Alex Garland about this film, and he says, "It's not my job to interpret." Fuck you.
You're the director. Yeah, yes, it is.
It is your job to interpret. You're going to bring me some kind of point of view. I, as your critic or as your audience member, can say how successful you were in doing that. But here you're doing nothing. So here we have an incredibly visceral, very shaking, very disturbing film about war violence. One of the better films you're going to see in terms of pure craft when it comes to war violence. Mm. And it is about nothing. Yeah. So it's really frustrating.
It's the Seinfeld of war films.
it's a war about nothing.
Yeah, I remember. We've made a lot of movies about the last like 30 years of military conflict, most of which has been in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we've had ones that are celebrated. We've had ones that were like roundly rejected.
Yeah.
I don't know if we've had a lot of, like, truly great ones that have a lot to say. Even, like, The Hurt Locker feels more like a character piece than anything else in terms of actually, like, really commenting on it. I'm not saying it's a bad movie. I'm just saying it really seems more focused on what these guys are going through. And,
What they're going through, but it also shows what the war experience does. It shows you about the endlessness of this particular war.
Yeah.
It actually has, like, some pretty important things to say about war and warfare and combat.
I'm talking about
America's involvement in specific wars.
Okay, maybe you liked it more than I did. For me, the one
I really like The Hurt Locker.
I know you do. For me, the one like film about the wars in the Middle East that are it's actually a miniseries was the HBO miniseries Generation Kill, which was I think it was also David Simon. Actually, now that I think about it, but. It has this, it's very much just here's what happened, but also this is a war fought by people who are overtrained and poorly managed, and there is this incredible, like, catch-22 irony to a lot of it, where America's ultra-competence, I keep using that word, it's the word of the week, and its ultra-fallibility are constantly at play with each other.
Hmm.
Like, our greatness is constantly undermined by our failure. And that's something. You know, actually, it's something. It's not necessarily... And I think it's very specific to the moment. And even when we look at a film that, like, ostensibly is about trying to be, like, almost apolitical, like some people thought it was, like Black Hawk Down. Hmm. No, it's not.
No.
You know, it's a hell of an achievement of filmmaking. It's one of the best edited movies you're ever going to see, because that's impossible to cover all that.
But it's really also about, like, military fetish.
There's an American exceptionalism to it.
Yeah.
There is a demonization of people who are not in the American military, almost all of whom are white in this movie.
Yeah.
Whether Ridley Scott meant it or not, who can say? It's all fucking in there.
Yeah,
I wonder what's the point of having a "you are there" experience, having something to say about that.
Yeah, Black Hawk Down is really interesting because that is a very kind of a jingoistic film.
Rah, rah.
It's based on this kind of philosophy that I think in that movie they could have just like dispensed with this philosophy, but it's like no man left behind. Yeah, leave one guy behind. That's fine. Everybody else get out, you know?
Well, okay.
Because now you've killed like four, how many other people died?
Yeah.
Like, getting that one guy out. It's like, yeah. No, leave me. I'm fine. You know, just,
you should be able to opt out, I guess. But yeah,
it's like,
you
know, no man left behind. Go, idiot. It's dangerous.
All right. Look, we're getting into insensitive territory there. We're going to move on.
I suppose so. There's nothing like
that.
Speaking
in the abstract, we're speaking in a film critic way about some stuff that is real.
Well, I'm also speaking about movies. You know, I'm not... I can't speak to the real experience of those soldiers. I can talk about what Ridley Scott...
Black Hat Down was based on real stuff.
I can
based
on what Ridley Scott made and his point of view on
this. He made
the
movie version, and there's an element of fakery to that. That's what we're discussing.
Yeah, and Ridley Scott, you know, decided to up the oorah American politics. Mm-hmm. Odd for a British filmmaker.
He knew his audience.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
Alex Garland and Ray Mendoza are really trying to pay honor to the experience of the soldiers. Mm-hmm. An actor named DeFaro Wunatai plays the Ray Mendoza character. Mm-hmm. And we get some other familiar faces. Charles Melton is in this. Will Poulter is in this. I really like Will Poulter.
Will Poulter's a good actor.
Kit Connor, Cosmo Jarvis. Like, these are actors you might recognize. But they just... They're not playing, like, textured, interesting characters. They're just there to... panic, be bored for a little bit, and then panic and survive. Mm-hmm. And then they survive. And that's it. And I wish it was to an end of some kind.
Yeah, bummer.
No matter what your political viewpoints are, you're going to be frustrated by this one. Because you're going to want it to say something, and it's not going to agree or disagree with you. And it's just going to come off as really non-committal.
Mm. Well, I can tell you a movie that has a very distinct point of view.
Yes.
The King of Kings... which is a film about how Jesus, pretty cool guy.
This is an animated film.
It's an animated film. It's a CG animated film from Angel Studios, because of course it is. And it is the story of Jesus Christ's life from beginning to end, and then the beginning again, and then we're going to kind of be hazy about what happened after that.
He ascended.
He ascended. Hmm. But then what? Sequel.
No, we're... Depending on what your religious viewpoint is, we might be still be waiting for that sequel.
That's true. But the framing device is weird. So this is based on a true thing. So Charles Dickens, famous author of Oliver Twist and David Copperfield and The Christmas Carol, Christmas Carol. He wrote for his kids his own version of the New Testament.
Okay.
Here's what happens in the New Testament. I'm going to put it in my own words.
All right.
And to his credit, never profited off of it in his lifetime.
Okay.
Didn't want it published in his lifetime. I don't think they published it until his kids died. Mm. And I've never read that, actually. So I can't speak to that. I can't speak to the accuracy of that. I can't say if this is a faithful adaptation of that version or not. I do know, however, that they chose to make that the framing device, and that's weird.
Oh, so Dickens is a character in
Dickens
this?
Dickens is a character. He's played by Kenneth Branagh.
All right.
At the beginning of it actually has a cute opening. I'll give him this. It opens with like the climax of A Christmas Carol with Ebenezer Scrooge seeing his grave, and it's all dramatic, and we all know the moment. And then
wait, this is a Jesus movie.
Hang on.
All right.
I'm going to give him credit for the opening because it's actually cute.
Oh, is this a cinematic universe? Is Jesus secretly the ghost of Christmas future?
Okay, I would actually love that. That would be awesome. But no. We're watching it. The ending is the snow. And, I can change. And then, like, something weird happens off camera and Scrooge gets a little confused. And then he tries to go back on about his business. And then we cut to Charles Dickens reading his story to an audience, which is what he actually did that.
Yeah.
And his performance is being interrupted because his wife and kids are backstage and his kids are being unruly. Okay. Mm-hmm. Cute. One of his youngest kid, Walter... is very into King Arthur, and he's running around with a fake sword, slaying dragons and shit, which isn't something King Arthur did. And Dickens is very upset with him. And him and his naughty cat, Willa. Oh, the comic relief cat. But his wife, played by Uma Thurman, says, the son of ours... Mm-hmm. You know, you think it's a problem that he loves kings. Why don't you tell him a story about the best king of all?
The King of Kings.
The King of Kings.
All right.
And Kenneth Branagh's, like, Charles Dickens is like, yeah, okay. And so this is the, and so he tells his youngest son the story of Jesus Christ. And in order for this plot to make sense, you have to believe that Charles Dickens is a very devout Christian, which maybe the serial adulterer was. He's rather famously an adulterer. We're not going to get into that, but maybe he was. He did do this thing for his kids. Fine. Maybe he believed in the religion. It's awesome. You also have to believe that he's never mentioned Christianity to his kids, because his son hasn't heard it. And towards the end of the movie, when his son is telling his brothers and his older siblings about it, they're just as surprised as he is to find out about this Jesus guy.
I think
that's weird, man.
Well, this is England. I'm sure there are sort of like default Anglicans.
Yeah, they would have gone to church. They would have gotten the gist of it, at least.
I think Dickens was a Unitarian, but I'd have to look that up.
I don't know, but my point is this. It would have come up a couple of times. These kids are in school. And this is a time when they didn't separate that. They would have at least heard about the Bible by now. Like, it's absurd premise.
But this is like in... this is Jack T. Chick.
Yeah.
In a lot of those little Chick tracts, our dear listener, you've probably run into a Jack T. Chick track.
These Whitney mentions them all the time.
Because I'm fascinated by these things. This weird version of Christianity that Jack T. Chick, this comic author, came up with. He wrote these little Christian parables in these little tiny comic books, and then he would just scatter them in public places. He'd leave them in bathrooms or just out on the street.
The size of like a flip book. They're like really like a little tiny thing you could just pick up off the ground. What is this? Oh, I'm going to hell.
Yeah, this was your life, and there's always going to be a moment in these things where, like a little kid, it's like, I'm going to be mean to my friend, and the gentle, you know, Christian Jack T. Chick insert character is going to say, you shouldn't do that because of Jesus. And they always say, who's he? You kind of know. Like, you've heard somebody yell Jesus Christ in traffic, right?
Yeah, like, you shouldn't be entirely shocked by this. So, the premise is ridiculous, but the basic movie is this. Charles Dickens is telling his son the story of Jesus Christ, and his son, in a somewhat Princess Bride kind of way, is like, well, when's he gonna fight a dragon? Oh, he's gonna do something even cooler than fight a dragon. He's gonna fight some money changers. Temple.
He's going to be tempted by Satan in the desert.
But here's the thing. And actually, to be fair, they're doing a greatest hits compilation. It's an hour and 40 minutes long, and it's an animated kids movie. I don't expect you to get deep in the weeds of this philosophically. I get it. So you're doing a lot of the greatest hits, right? Wow. So you're going to do him dueling wits with Lucifer in the desert. You're going to do him exercising demons, raising the dead. So the whole let ye who without sin throw the first stone bit. Hmm. The classics. It's a greatest hits compilation. But it's a greatest hits compilation, like, without Piano Man or Pressure in it, because they left out a few. They left out a few biggins, like Mary Magdalene.
She's not in it?
There's a different Mary, who is sometimes conflated with Mary Magdalene, but yeah, we're kind of going to gloss over that whole bit. The whole Sermon on the Mount, I don't recall coming up. Kind of feels like a big one to me.
I think...
A lot of the philosophy, a lot of the basic tenets... kind of illustrated quite clearly, not doing that. The whole easier for a camel to get through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to get into heaven, notably absent. A lot of the big ones are missing. And
well, that would have been cool, like, and they cut back to the kid, like Dickens' son. Hey, Dad, aren't you rich? You know what? You've made me think about something, son.
That would have been great, right? That would have been kind of cool, but no, we're not doing that. But there is they do a thing where it's like, you know, King Herod is announced that all the babies are gonna be killed, and he's like, oh, he could do that? Yes, terrible tyrants often make up their own rules. Oh, you mean like the rule about how we're not allowed in your office when you're working? And I'm like, no, that one's actually quite reasonable. You can't equate the two here. This one is a genocide. One is, I'm working, could you please bother me later? Like, not the same thing. Jesus is voiced by Oscar Isaac.
Okay.
Oscar Isaac grumbles a lot. Like, he really doesn't seem like he was given a lot of material. Jesus is not particularly well animated. He looks a little soulless. And indeed, the animation quality ranges from competent to not very good. There's a couple of bits where they clearly like spent.
Knocking things over. Sorry about that.
There's a couple of bits where they clearly spent some extra money. And they tried to make it look very cinematic and dazzling. And there's a couple of moments where it's like, yeah, it looks pretty cool. But then Jesus is on screen, and it's just like, did we forget to animate him a few times? He's barely moving. He's not acting a lot. And a lot of the times when characters do act, they're just sort of swinging their arms wildly a little bit. It's not embarrassing, but it's clearly not top-notch. We had all the time in the world animation.
An issue I have with a lot of movies about Jesus Christ is how they treat him as this sort of like peerless, I mean, it's Jesus Christ. Peerlessly scrupulous character who is just, you know, like,
look at how great he was.
Pastorally peaceful, like unbearably pure and pastorally innocent. And, you know, we're just sort of supposed to take for granted that we love Jesus. Rather than having something to say about Jesus.
Right.
Or giving Jesus any kind of personality.
Yeah, this is not one of those movies where they give Jesus a personality.
That's too bad.
It is too bad, actually. Because
that's the way to make a Jesus movie.
No, it is. Because the whole thing is, he's basically focusing on, here are all the miracles he did to prove he was Jesus. Aren't you impressed that he was Jesus? And I'm like, yeah. It really wouldn't have taken a lot of effort to give him some personality. And he's basically just like, yeah, I'm a cool guy, man. Lucifer can't do nothing to me. Oh, man, all these people don't have food. Well, give him some of that shit. I don't know. That's cool.
Give him some of that shit.
Towards the end of his life, Jesus starts getting a little bit more emotionally invested. There's the whole bit where, like, you turned my father's temple into a marketplace? Get to act a little. Get to, like, show some energy. I do appreciate the bit where he was like, I asked you to pray with me for an hour and you couldn't stay awake.
Yeah.
The mind was willing, but the flesh was weak, huh, fuckers? Yeah. Like, that's not what he says, but that's the tone. And that's fair. Right. But, like, he's not a character.
Does it get to, like, the passion and the crucifixion?
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah, we're skimming over it a little bit, but yeah, he does get beaten, he does get murdered, he does get crucified. It could be grosser than it is, thank God, but, like, it's still, you know, it's in there, it's a lot. And, of course, the child is horrified. Oh, how could they do this? Well, you know, it was a good thing. I'm like, really? Okay. And, like, there's a bit where, like, because, like, the Last Supper, I think, was a Seder. The kid's like, well, what's Passover? And he's like, wow, I haven't said anything to you, have I? Oh, my God. I need to talk to my kids more. Anyway, Passover was like, you remember when all the Jews were in Egypt and they were enslaved? And God was like, I'm going to send all of these plagues. And the last plague was the worst of all. And I will go into no more detail.
Because, oh, so it doesn't actually explain what
not very well. Passover no, is, gonna right. get a good thing, but like the people who were spared were passed over, and I'm like, yeah, a little bit more detail there. It's a bit more going on in that story. Right. It's kind of complicated. That's the problem. You're distilling a complicated, like, whether you believe in the Bible or not, it is a complicated historical, cultural, religious, and philosophical text.
Yes,
it's a lot of historical accuracy and historical inaccuracy. It's a lot of philosophies that contradict each other and rules that contradict each other. And just, it's a lot. So I don't expect the kids' version to get into all that. I don't. I get it. You're doing a story for kids so that they'll think Jesus is cool. Well, that's your audience. I'm not going to pretend that there's nothing to that. That's a reason to make a thing.
Is it Jesus is cool and he's so cool you should go to church? Is this proselytizing?
Oh, it's proselytizing. Or, yeah.
Okay, that I don't like that.
No.
It's or, like, or is it's, it like yeah. Jesus was cool because he actually had these cool ideas and those are good things you can use in your life?
It's not really idea based. Like he's a moral guy.
Yeah,
and that's a good thing to be. But, you know, we're not really engaging with Jesus. Because, you know, like, there's a lot of reasons why Jesus was crucified. And there's the really obvious plot-centric one. But also, he was challenging the status quo.
Mm-hmm.
Like, beyond just those guys who were mad at him. Like, he was challenging the status quo. He was a political dissident, basically.
So that this and is so, no like, different from just any Jesus picture book.
It's not particularly different from any Jesus picture book. Like, there's a few bits. There's, like, a bit in the movie, which is, you know, it's heavy-handed, but it's a Jesus movie. I'm not going to discount it just for that. where the kid finally like gets over his thing about heroism being a certain way and kind of accepts Jesus into his heart. And it's actually kind of beautifully conceived.
Okay.
And like it's kind of actually very pretty and lovely. And I'm like, oh, that's actually kind of nice. And then it ends and the kid's like, you know, ah, Jesus, I'm going to tell all of my siblings who you didn't tell this story to for some reason, even though they're older than me. I don't understand any of this, but
there would have been if this is Dickens, it would have been great if there was a scene where it's like, and yeah, Jesus flipped the tables of the moneylenders in the temple, yeah. And he would have said, oh yeah, you do that in your books a lot. You sort of excoriate the systems that lead to extreme poverty. Well, that's actually a common theme in your works, Dad.
If you were doing a story about Dickens, yeah, but this is just a framing device, and I think. Honestly, the idea that kids are super invested in the idea of Charles Dickens as a framing device is kind of giving kids a lot of credit, considering the age demographic this is for little kids.
I didn't read Dickens until high school. You know?
Yeah, and most people, like, if they do know Dickens as a kid, they know The Christmas Carol, they're not going to be like, yeah, man, Uriah Heep was an asshole. Like, they're not gonna be as invested in it on that level, so I understand not getting into it. But here's the thing, and I complained about this when Angel Studios did Homestead, a movie which was otherwise, you know, it had problems, but actually seemed pretty good and had a pretty good message, until the credits. So you just did a movie in which we explicitly saw Jesus Christ say that it was despicable. Jesus Christ, who has been a chill dude this entire time, became violently angry because people tried to make money off of religion.
Mm.
Stay tuned during the credits for a very special message. Now here's a bunch of live-action children, like real kids, who are saying, I loved this movie that we just watched. You shouldn't have to tell us that we liked it, but okay. I like this movie, and I think every kid should see this movie, and so you should buy extra tickets now. You can use your QR code. It's okay to take your phone out in the theater.
Okay, so they're not, like, shilling for a charity or something.
No, they're shilling for the studio. The studio is my understanding. Yeah, okay. If it was for a charity, I'd say fine.
Yeah.
You know, it's a bit gauche, but, like, yeah, it's fine. You know, that would be for a good cause. They're doing it for Angel Studios. You're not giving this money to a charity. You're buying extra tickets. So that people who couldn't see the film will get to, which is not my top concern. I will say this, Angel Studios did do a thing, which is almost putting their money where their mouth is, where they said, kids get in free.
Okay.
Which would have been great. It's actually, like, one kid, like, per adult.
Okay.
Which is not strictly kids get, but that's close enough.
Kids actually, don't get to be go fair, movies by themselves anyway.
And honestly, this is a huge deterrent for people to be in theaters anyway, because especially once you're going with your family and you're getting snacks and parking and stuff, one trip to the movies can be over $100 very easily.
Yeah.
So that's not in and of itself a horrible thing. But to then say, Jesus wants us to make this money, is basically the vibe. And, you know, if you're a good Christian, you will give us more money for our movies. No. No. It comes across as extremely hypocritical. And all I can imagine two things happening right now that would make sense. One, the screen getting hit by lightning would be perfectly adequate. But the one that would be even better is Jesus, from the movie, I'll take the weird animated version, Jesus walking into the theater going, you turned my life into a marketplace? And you just had this scene! I know you cut out the rich people eye of the needle thing, like, notably, but you left in the other one. What are we even doing here? I do not approve of this marketing model. Mm-hmm. I really don't. Kickstart it if you must. Say, like, here's what we're doing. We want to make this movie. We want to spread the word of Jesus, and we think that'd be a good thing. Please support the film. Fine. You're being upfront about it. But to get people into the theater, and then while they're here, after you have sold them on the idea of your beneficence making this Jesus movie, to then panhandle for more money, not for a charity, but for more tickets, which, by the way, if you buy more tickets, you're inflating the success of the movie, so it feels like more people bought tickets than they actually did.
Yeah.
So It's functionally a scam. I don't know if it legally qualifies as a scam, but functionally it is.
Yeah.
That's not very Jesus-y. I can't take your movie seriously. I was willing to give it a bit of a pass because it seemed like it had its heart in the right place. And then it's like, oh, no, actually you don't. Shit. Okay, well, never fucking mind, I guess. That was a waste of everyone's fucking time and money. Yeah. So, generally speaking, it's not terrible. It's not particularly good. And the premise is kind of laughable with the whole framing device. But it has no strength of its conviction. How can I support that when the whole point of making a movie about telling kids how great Jesus is so that they would appreciate his teachings, right? And a lot of the things, I'm not a Christian. Jesus said some cool stuff. There's a lot of things Jesus says in that Bible where I'm like, you know what? That's a good one.
Jesus was way cool.
Jesus was pretty cool. But for the most part, like, I think Jesus said some really cool shit. And I think, you know, we could all, you know, take some, at least some of it to heart. And this is a movie that takes none of it to heart, which really sucks. I don't know if maybe this was always the plan, or they made this movie and Angel Studios bought it. If they made the movie and Angel Studios bought it and tacked that on at the end, this was never part of the original plan of the filmmakers,
yeah,
I would be fucking furious with them.
With Angel, yeah.
Yeah, I would be absolutely incensed by this. How dare you sully something that we at least tried to do in literal good faith.
It sounds like for in like the mid to late 2000s, Christian cinema was in a really awful place.
Yeah,
it was just as bad as you would hear.
Yeah, a lot like a of really, Kirk Cameron,
a lot of Kirk Cameron, a lot of really specious arguments, a lot of really badly made arguments about how, you know, believing in Jesus will just fix all of the problems in your life. I feel like in the mid-2000s, they started to get a little more nuanced. They started to look at Christianity as a workable life philosophy rather than just accepting Jesus into your heart is good for us.
I think they also started, I don't know if the people who were making the movies had made enough movies that they just got better, or they started attracting better talent, but there were a lot of better,
they got better actors.
A lot of, like, especially the independent Christian films started to get, you know, a little stronger in quality.
Yeah, like, I didn't see the one with, what was it, The Best Christmas Pageant Ever?
That was a really good one! You reviewed that one. I genuinely loved that movie. And I think they nailed that movie.
And I think that's Angel Studios, isn't it? It's a Christian movie anyway. It's about churchgoers.
No, that's, again, I have no objection to a Christian movie in theory, but if you make a movie that espouses Christian morals and you don't have them, I can't take you very seriously.
Yeah.
But that's a movie that does, actually. And I'm going to look it up and see if that's Angel Studios. Because that's Angel Studios, good for them. They nailed it that time.
I saw a preview for another upcoming Angel film with Neil McDonough, an actor I like.
He was in Homestead as well.
Yeah, he plays a lot of supporting characters. He plays a lead in this one. Good. Neil McDonough got some more work. And it's about, you know, a rodeo rider trying to, like, find his feet again.
Best Christmas Pageant Ever was not Angel Studios. It was the Kingdom Story Company and a bunch of other small places as well. And it was distributed by Lionsgate.
Oh, okay.
So it wasn't Angel Studios that did that one. It was some other, I assume, Kingdom Story Company based on the name is Christian. But, they make Christian films in partnership with Lionsgate. I wonder if they've done anything else I've seen. Hang on.
But, yeah, I feel like a lot of these Christian studios kind of figured out how to make movies better. We're far off from something like...
Luca, stop doing that.
That's the cat making some noise over there.
He found like a box with like some packing materials in it. They just did it. They also did a film that just came out that I missed called The Unbreakable Boy.
Oh, yeah.
Which I heard wasn't very good, but I didn't see it for myself, so I cannot speak to it.
But yeah, it feels like they're slipping back into like obvious proselytizing in a way that's not seemly,
right?
Where they're just sort of leaning on this idea that by being Christian, your life will somehow improve.
Yeah,
and I don't like that message.
I don't think it's the best. I don't think it's the best selling point. Anyway, we have one more movie to review, don't we? It's a documentary.
Documentary film.
Yeah, about someone who is bigger than Jesus.
Indeed.
Yeah.
This is a documentary about John Lennon and Yoko Ono, specifically their lives as it was in 1972.
Okay, so it's after the Beatles broke up.
It's after the Beatles broke up. And it's less a documentary and more kind of like a media montage.
Okay.
The filmmaker who is... Kevin MacDonald, who's done a lot of like music biopics and music documentaries, found sort of the apartment where they were living in in New York, and just sort of put the camera in there, looked around, found a lot of sort of video footage at the time, and the bookend material is some newly discovered footage of them performing at Madison Square Garden. John and Yoko, I think it's the only only solo concert John Lennon did after the Beatles broke up.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's a bummer. Yeah, weirdly. Because the Beatles stopped doing concerts after a while. They only just released albums, and that's why that rooftop concert was such a big deal.
I think it was like the only like full John Lennon concert after the breakup of the Beatles.
Yeah, I didn't know about that. That's weird.
And yeah, it was John and Yoko. And so we get a few clips of that concert. We get to hear some of those songs performed. Meanwhile, the camera just sort of lingers around sort of their actual physical apartment, the way it looks today. And it's been restored to the way it was. And also a lot of audio clips. They found old like phone calls that they went on. There was a phone call of John Lennon talking to Alan Klein. And when Alan Klein's name appears on screen, you can hear all of the Beatles fans going, "Boo!"
For people who don't know, Alan Klein.
Asshole producer of the Beatles. Yeah. He's the reason we didn't get to see Alejandro Jodorowsky movies for like decades.
Ah.
The ABCO, that was Alan Klein. But we also get to hear Yoko Ono on the telephone sort of talking about how unfairly she's being treated.
Well, she was vilified in the press.
Yeah,
you
she
know?
Was vil- and she understood that. And, she, and yeah. I like that now, like decades later, she's like 92 now.
Yeah.
People are finally saying, okay, Yoko, you're great.
Like, she was a fascinating artist.
We understand that you're a great artist. If you the way we were treated in the 70s is bullshit.
She did a great song about how being with John Lennon screwed her career over because everyone thought of her as Mrs. Lennon. She did a great song called Mrs. Lennon.
Mrs. Lennon, yeah.
It's really, really awesome. Yeah.
And we actually get to hear a little bit about her story. Yeah. She actually had a child from her first marriage that she didn't get to see for a long time just because of the complications around divorce. And she talks about how she is just being unfairly treated and how people are spitting on her and how she's just, and how much she hates that. And we get to hear John Lennon come to her defense time and time again.
Yeah.
He's never throwing her under the bus. And good for him.
Yeah.
There's a bit where he's discussing the concert and what's going to be on the playlist. He's like, well, I'd like to come out and I'd like Yoko to come out and we can do this song together. And they're saying, well, could you do this other song? Well, Yoko doesn't know that one. She knows how to do this other one and I like it better anyway. So can we do that song? And like, he's actually trying to put together a concert. It's him and Yoko. They are the artistic unit.
And they're trying to subtly move him away from including Yoko at all.
You can kind of tell that's what the producers might be doing.
But they don't want to actually say it out loud, but seriously, would you just mind not having Yoko on there because you're John
Lennon? Like, it's not quite as silly.
That's
like,
my point.
That's
the implication.
Yeah, so it sort of is this wonderful, and the filmmakers also cut in to try to give you a good context. It's not just about them. We have to know kind of who they are, the world they live in, and what they're responding to. What is their music about at this point?
Yeah.
And so we actually get a lot of clips of Richard Nixon and clips from the Vietnam War and a lot of the protests that were going on. There's a clip of Nixon going to some sort of choral performance and how before the performance began, somebody stepped forward and says, "We need you to stop the killing, Mr. Nixon," and they're holding up signs. In addition to all of this, all these clips about Richard Nixon, about the war and sort of the political upheaval at the time, there's also ads, like vintage TV commercials.
Oh, okay. Like with John and Yoko?
From the era.
Oh, just in general. Okay.
Just to sort of give you an idea of, like, and it kind of makes a lot of this seem so crass. It's like, here's all of this, political music and important movements that are being sort of actually taking place in the real world. Here's some preventable violence that can be stopped. Here are the politicians who are dancing the night away while it's going on. Oh, and buy Clorox. You know, it makes it all seem so absurd. And I feel like that's
we're doing that right now.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And this has always been a rather interesting wrinkle in America, hasn't it? The fact that there can be violence going around all around the world, but you can still turn on your TV and see commercials for grand lives thanks to your purchase of Lucky Charms. I like that that has been incorporated in it as well, which makes it feel like this big media montage, this kind of big mood piece of what it looked like in 1972. And something I didn't know about the concert, that the one-to-one concert that they put on, was we actually get to see the TV report that inspired the concert. It turns out it was, let me look it up, the Willowbrook Institute, which was where... it was a benefit concert for this mental hospital where developmentally disadvantaged kids were being kept and they didn't have any money. And they were essentially just being kept naked in dark rooms.
Yeah, I've heard
that. You probably have read about this. Horrifying Willowbrook Institute. And how the whole point of the concert was to raise money for this hospital and to save these kids. And the kids got to come to the concert. And yes, their lives did improve because of this concert. So all of this is this wonderful little time capsule. What more can be said about the Beatles, after all? They've been scoured so thoroughly in their lives. There have been so many films and so many documentaries and so many biopics. Mm-hmm. There's even more coming about the Beatles.
And listen, they're interesting guys and they made great music, like, a lot for a long time. But, like, after a while, like, one of the radio stations I listen to on my, like, digital radio thing... is just Beatles. You can always turn on Beatles and it's Beatles, or maybe it's some of their solo career, or maybe it's a weird B-side or an early recording or whatever. It's great. But, like, I was listening to it just earlier today or yesterday, and it was like, yes, welcome to this special show on the Beatles. For this hour, we're listening only to Beatles songs with the words Mr., Mrs., or Ms. in the title. And I'm like...
You're stretching now.
We're running out of ideas, right? There's a lot of Beatles out there, but I think we're running a little low.
And they're really fascinating, and I feel like when we get into the politics of the Beatles, they get a little more interesting. And I also like this idea that we can catch up with John Lennon and Yoko Ono and sort of look at them, like, just where they were in this 18-month period and focus on that. And I think we can extrapolate a lot from that.
It's weird that we don't talk about the post-Beatles-Lennon years more in popular culture. I mean, certainly it's out there.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, we're so focused on the actual Beatles part.
Just the war is over if you want it, that kind
of
stuff.
I mean, some of the songs are still relevant, but, like, we just don't, like... talk about, like, what was on John Lennon's mind as much as we do when he was like, hey, remember when you wrote that Beatles song we like?
I would go to bat for Imagine, but,
I think he did incredible work. I think he did incredible work after he left the Beatles. I think all the Beatles did varying degrees of incredible work.
Yeah.
I mean, Paul's made so much stuff that some of it does suck, but, like, Ringo stuff is fun. George's stuff was actually very enlightening and wonderful. And John Lennon's stuff post-Beatles was very angry.
Yeah.
And just very different than a lot of his Beatles work. And it's nice to see that get attention, that era. And also, sounds like Yoko Ono actually got some respect on her name, which is good. She deserves it.
I've seen Paul McCartney in concert.
Nice. I've seen Yoko Ono on the streets of New York.
No kidding.
Yeah, I was there in college.
Just walking around, or was
just walking around. Oh, okay. I was in college. We were doing this, like, 1800s death comedy musical that had never actually been performed before.
Okay.
So we got to play at the Lincoln Center, like, one performance, but it was cool. And I had just walking around New York. I'm like 20. You know, the world is my oyster.
And Yoko Ono's just walking the other way.
Holy shit, wow. I wish I was brave enough to say something to her. I wasn't.
Hey, remember how you're Yoko Ono and that's cool?
That was cool. Hey, did you see that Powerpuff Girls episode about you guys? Probably shouldn't have brought that up. Okay, bye.
What I appreciate, Yoko Ono has always known how she's been seen. Yep. You know, she couldn't avoid it. And that this documentary actually proves that. And I love when she gets to kind of riff on her image a little bit. I saw an episode of Mad About You, if you remember that sitcom.
I do remember that sitcom.
Where she had a guest spot.
No, and, I don't remember that at all.
And I don't remember the context, but the main characters are like, okay, we're going to go see Yoko Ono. And we're you know, starstruck. You know, we haven't met her yet, but we're going to see Yoko Ono. And we're really nervous to meet her.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, but, like, do we talk about the Beatles? Like, that is, we can't bring it up. Like, we can't talk, and they resolve. Yeah. We're not going to even mention the Beatles. Like, right. we know her work, so we'll talk about her own work, but we're not ever going to bring up John Lennon. Yeah. We'll talk about John Lennon, you know, as her husband, but not as a musician.
Right.
Hey, don't mention the Beatles. Okay, knock on the door, and she opens the door, and she's playing, like, blasting, I Want to Hold Your Hand. So it's like...
Good for her. Good for her. That's a cute joke to be a part of.
She's game. She's very funny. And I like that this film is like adding to this Yoko Ono renaissance that seems to be in the works.
Seriously, genuinely good for her.
Yeah.
All right. That is it for Critically Acclaimed. Let's do our reviews on our review roundup. We review movies on a scale of C- to C+. A C+ is a movie we recommend, whether we think it's just quite good or the best movie ever. A C is an average movie, you know, mixed bag, kind of and then a C- is a movie that is below average. We do not recommend movies that are C-. We may be wrong. Maybe you like it more than we do. But generally speaking, we're like, it's not particularly good. On that note, John and Yoko something something.
1-to-1.
It's 1-to-1, colon, 1-to-1,
colon, John and Yoko. 1-to-1 was the name of the concert.
Yeah.
C+. Okay. I really like it. I really like sort of the mood it captures. It's a little bit miniaturized as a microcosm, but that's all it aims to be, and it does it very well.
Okay. The King of Kings, the animated Jesus epic, would have been a C. Would have been a rock solid, not particularly amazing, but perfectly fine C, until Angel Studios whizzed it down their leg by doing something Jesus would have hated them for. Based on their own movie, by the way. I'm not even, like, adding my own thing. It's like, the movie they made, that guy would have hated what they did at the end of it. Like, clearly, like, as a plot point. So, big ol' C-. Let's see what we give. Warfare. Yeah.
Warfare, I'm going to give a C, because it is just very, very... viscerally, to use the crit word, powerful. It really does strike you. It's going to shake you with its violence and with its noise and with sort of just how raw physically it makes you feel.
Yeah.
But it has nothing to say, and that's so galling.
Weird.
That it doesn't ruin the film because you're so wrapped up in it, but golly, what are you doing? Why are you standing back from this?
Yeah. G20, the Die Hard knockoff starring Viola Davis as the President of the United States, it's nowhere near well put together enough to be a C+.
That's too bad.
But it's too entertaining to be a C-. It is a silly, kind of insipid, Viola Davis brings it, and really, she did not have to, kind of film. But it's hard not to just, in principle... see cool Viola Davis president beat the shit out of guys like incompetent assholes who were trying to wreck the world economy. There's a part of you where it's like, it can't be bad, honestly. Like, it's not particularly well put together, but it can't be bad. So I'm going to give it a high C. All
right.
You know, like, could have been great. Didn't make it.
All right.
Let's see. With the Drop.
It's just Drop.
I'm sorry. Drop.
Yeah. Drop is a C+. This is one of the best films of the year.
That's saying a lot.
I dug it so hard. I was just clapping my little hands, having a gloriously good time at the movies. Right. It just, everything functions well for me.
Nice. And then lastly, The Amateur, I'm going to give it a C. Mm-hmm. I think it is, like, you can get through it, and it does its thing, and it's never particularly remarkable. It's riddled with cliche. But it's also never... terrible. There's never anything in it where I'm like, I'm super bored right now, or I'm mad at this movie or whatever. It's just sort of like, yeah, you made a film, so I'm gonna give it a C.
It's so dull. It's just not fun to watch. It's not offensive, but
I don't
wish...
have to be fun.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is this fun spy caper not supposed to be fun? No, I'm giving it a C-, okay. Because it's not fun. It's the characters aren't interesting. The script is clunky, but you can turn a clunky script into something fun if you have a little bit of style. And this film didn't have that style. Bummer. It was missing everything that makes this kind of caper fun to watch.
All right. Well, that is it for Critically Acclaimed. We'll be back next week with a review of Sinners. The new Ryan Coogler 1930s gangster picture starring Michael B. Jordan as...
And Michael B. Jordan.
Yes. Oh, I feel like it should be Michael B. Jordan and Michael A. Jordan. since they're playing identical twins. But yeah, it's a blues musical gangster epic vampire film set in the 1930s shot on IMAX. What?
Thanks for making a movie for me.
Fuck yeah, yeah, Ryan. Holy shit, dude. Fucking take that Warner Brothers money. Like, you do it, man. Anyway, so that's coming up, and we'll review other things as well. Thank you for listening. Thank you for joining us. Huge shout out to all of our patrons over at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork.
Thank you for subscribing. You guys are awesome.
You guys are super awesome, and we couldn't do this without you. We couldn't make all our shows without you. You're just the absolute best. If you want to join up and support the show, if you have the means, we sure would love to have you. You get a lot of exclusive material, hundreds of hours of podcasts, depending on the tier that you're on, will unlock like immediately. So, but we have other cool stuff coming in the future. We're very excited about it. Patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. We would love to see you there. If you want to talk about anything we discussed in this episode or anything else, you want to take me to task for how I reviewed King of Kings, or do you think Warfare is really meaningful, or yeah, do you just want to ask us questions about whatever, our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Whitney, what is our P.O. Box?
Yeah, send us a physical letter, postcard, whatever you like, to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yeah, we might review, listen, we might read and respond to your letter on an upcoming episode of We've Got Mail. We're on social media. Specifically, we're at Blue Sky, at Critic Acclaim. I am at William DeBiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibel.
And that's okay. It. Never forget everyone's a critic, okay? Just don't do that.
I wanna go to the midnight show. I'm sorry, what?